there, listeners. Welcome to episode 208 of Never on the Back Foot podcast. The Ashes are still alive. England's batters clinched a 3-wicket win in a white-knuckled run chase at Headingley, led by Harry Brooks' 75 on his home ground before Chris Wokes and Mark Wood took them across the line. On the podcast, we will discuss all about that test match and much more. On the podcast today, we have Surya Sesha. He is a cricket journalist and a featured writer at Sportskeeda and also jointly heads the features team there. He has been a passionate cricket tragic since the age of 9 and has been in the profession for close to 2 years now. And like many others, he was once upon a time an engineer. Without further ado, let's get started. Hi, Surya. Welcome to Never on the Back Foot podcast. First things first, how are you feeling today?
It feels really great, Neha. Thank you so much for inviting me on your show. It is my podcast debut and I'm quite honored and glad to be able to do it with you. You run a very wonderful podcast and you've been going great. So I'm looking forward to this and thank you for finding me worthy enough to be a part of your show.
Really kind words, and thank you so much, you know, for coming on board as well. As you rightly said, our topic is also quite interesting, you know, like when you look at England, they finally made this comeback and they seem to have woken up from their sleep and, you know, they actually gave a fight back to make the scoreline 1-2 and they added just so much life to the series. So what are your thoughts to, you know, just kickstart our discussion?
You know, it wasn't surprising at all to see England bounce back because I think the way the first two tests panned out, it could have gone their way as well if the rubber, the green, you know, had favoured them instead of Australia. I think they played some very good cricket in the first two tests. But obviously, there were some critical moments which Australia certainly got the better out of. And after all that transpired at Lord's, you know, with the stumping of Johnny Bairstow and everything that had happened, you know, the media questioning, you know, whether Australia were right or wrong, and that the quintessential topic of the spirit of cricket, you know, emerging out of it. I think somewhere around all of us knew that England would come out with an added fire in their belly, and it reflected in the way they performed at Headingley. So I'm not surprised that England bounced back the way they did. And, you know, certainly playing a couple of fresh faces without the baggage of the first two tests helped their cause too. So from a neutral's point of view, I think it's just set up beautifully because two cracking test matches to go and it's all up in the air. So, I mean, this is the Ashes. This is what we expect. And, you know, it's been superb, you know, so far. And I guess it's only set the tone for two more, you know, cracking test matches ahead of us. And, you know, it should be really fascinating to watch.
Absolutely, because, you know, considering how the first two tests were really like, you know, Australia won and felt very dominant towards them, it was glad to see England, it was really nice to see England really make that comeback as well. So, you know, to just start off with the match as well, now England won the toss, they decided to bowl first. So, do you think it was a great decision to, you know, start?
You know, it's quite interesting because if you win the toss and you choose to bowl first in a 5-day game, you got to be absolutely sure that you can bowl the opposition out at the earliest. And England ticked that box off, you know, a little while after tea, they managed to roll Australia over. And obviously, they, you know, it was a bold decision in a way because it backfired at Lord's when they went by the overhead conditions and decided to bowl. But it fell flat on their face when Steve Smith just parked his car and, you know, didn't move from there. But, and we saw that it backfired for India as well in the WTC final. So, you know, it was a brave decision in a way, but perhaps the fact that this was a quicker wicket than the first two tests, you know, this definitely had a lot more spice in it for the bowlers, must have prompted England towards taking that call. And also somewhere around, I just wonder if, you know, it could be a bold question on my part, but do they trust their batters' defensive game enough to weather out, you know, tricky passages of play, especially when the ball is moving around? Because there was a test last year at Lord's where South Africa won by an innings, and that was the one test in the pass ball era, so to say, that you know, England really struggled to put up a show of note with the bat. And maybe they trust their bowling as their strongest suit to be able to you know, make those inroads early on and put the opposition under pressure, And at the same time, Headingley historically is a pitch which hasn't really deteriorated drastically as the game has gone on. So, you know, they still batted when they batted second or when they batted last, they still had decent batting conditions. So the pitch never really deteriorated except for the odd uneven bounce. So, you know, I think they would have backed themselves to chase down a target. And we've seen them do it on a consistent basis as well, you know, under McCullum and Stokes. So I think it did come with a bit of courage to bowl first again, but kudos to them, you know, they backed it up and you know, delivered the knockout punch.
Absolutely, and dialing back a little bit to their selection as well. Now they came into this test with two major changes, right? You had Josh Tung and Jimmy Anderson being kept out, and you had the likes of Chris Wokes and Mark Wood, you know, marking their return as well. So, what did you make of these changes?
I think the inclusions were positive ones. I remember putting out a tweet as well prior to the match that Wood and Wokes would have to come in because England needed fresh legs. You know, I wasn't in favor of Josh Tung's exclusion. You know, I really felt that he was their best bowler, hands down at Lord's. And, you know, he would have added an extra point of difference because I think he's probably the quickest bowler in the side after Mark Wood. And, you know, the way he bowled at Lord's, his confidence would have been up to, and, you know, Australia haven't faced too much of him. And I did feel that Ollie Robinson didn't look match fit in the first two tests, or test match fit to be particular. You know, both Robinson and Anderson were thrust back into the first test on the flattest pitch that you could find at Edgbaston. And, you know, they were bound to struggle because, you know, one thing, the conditions didn't really favor them. You didn't really want to be a bowler there unless you had that extra yard of pace, and England's attack looked extremely one-dimensional. And at the same time, you know, when you're coming back from injury, you're bound to take a bit of time to get into your rhythm. And very clearly, Robinson looked cooked after the first two tests. And, you know, it's a different story that England managed to win this test, you know, despite being a bowler down for a good part of the test. You know, Robinson went off the field. But, you know, I would have probably swapped Robinson out, retained Tung, and then got both Wood and Wokes for Anderson and Robinson. But the inclusions were positive, and, you know, the impact that they left with the ball and, of course, with the bat as well, you know, went a long way in England bouncing back.
Exactly, they just emerged as heroes, you know, at the end of that match. But even when you look at Australia's first innings, right, they had a very tricky start, losing their top four easily, giving England like a huge advantage on that day one. And we again saw, you know, Stuart Broad get his bunny in the form of David Warner. So, what do you think just transpired like with the batting there?
Oh, my heart just goes out to David Warner at times, every time he has to take guard against Stuart Broad. And pretty clearly, you saw in the second innings, it was Usman Khawaja who took strike first up because, you know, he knew that Stuart Broad would bowl the first over. And, you know, when somebody has your number, there's just nothing much you can do about it, I suppose, at the end of the day. I mean, 17 times is quite a staggering statistic. But, you know, I think, as I said, this was probably the best time to be a bowler in the series. Because there was movement in the air, you know, the ball was flying pretty fast off the pitch as well. There was just that little bit of extra fizz here, which was lacking at Lord's and at Edgbaston, and Australia succumbed to it, you know. And life became difficult when Manus Labuschagne and Steve Smith couldn't get going either. Usman Khawaja also had a rare failure, so you know, I think England struck the right chord. But I would say in that particular passage of play in the first session, the most exhilarating period was when Mark Wood had the ball in hand. You know, he was just firing rockets at will, you know, 95 miles an hour to do it regularly. You know, he was down on the floor half the time as well on his follow-through. But, you know, to be able to go back to the top of your mark and just steam in and just show why, you know, you add that cutting edge and that point of difference, I think he was, you know, he was superlative. And you just didn't want to be a batter at that point of time. He was scary. So, you know, I think England definitely, you know, walked the talk and they called the shots early on. You know, they were confident that they could bounce back and they showed it.
I mean, in spite of this onslaught, you know, by the English bowlers, you still had positives for Australia, right? In the form of Travis Head and Mitch Marsh. They really saved the day, like, especially Mitch Marsh, who proved his mettle, you know, as this premier all-rounder. So, how would you assess his knock and the context of that performance for England, for Australia?
Oh, that was brilliant. I mean, I've seen a lot of good counter-attacking knocks in Test cricket in recent times. You know, Travis Head has played a lot of them. Harry Brook, Joe Root, they've all played it. Rishabh Pant has played some of the all-time great counter-attacking knocks. But this one's right up there. It was right out of the top drawer because, you know, you're talking about someone who, when I woke up that morning, the last thing I had in mind was seeing Mitchell Marsh get 100. And it's not because Mitchell Marsh isn't good enough. It's simply because I had no idea that Cameron Green was carrying a niggle and Mitchell Marsh would be in the playing 11. I hadn't envisioned the possibility of Mitchell Marsh playing. And he was just superb, you know. And unfortunately for Mitchell Marsh, you know, he said it 4 years ago as well. It's a pretty famous statement that, you know, he's hated back home in Australia. And it's pretty sad when you hear, you know, a top cricketer say that because, you know, obviously whenever they step out onto the park, they always want to put their best foot forward. But with Marsh, I think I could just see a mentally unshackled Mitchell Marsh, not just because of the tempo with which he approaches innings, but there was just a lot of assurance, even in his defense. You know, there was this trigger movement as the bowler loaded up. He was covering the stumps to negate LBW. You know, the incoming delivery has caused him a bit of problem over time. And, you know, he managed to negate LBW. And barring that one blemish where he was dropped by Joe Root shortly after lunch, you know, he was just flawless. And anything wide, he just latched onto it. And you can bowl short to Travis Head. You cannot bowl short to Mitchell Marsh. You can meet him up at 3 in the morning. He'll still dump the ball into the fence. You know, he's that good against a short ball. And, you know, he was leaving the ball very well too. You know, he just picked the lateral movement quite well. And anytime there was a scoring opportunity, he just put it away. I mean, it was a chanceless innings, a near chanceless innings, at least in many ways. And, you know, as I said, I just think he has put in some work, you know, behind the scenes. But at the same time, he just seemed mentally unshackled and very fresh. And I hope this is the start of a second coming because, you know, ahead of that test, he averaged just 25 with the bat in test cricket. And that so does not do justice to the talent that he has. So I really hope the curve just goes onwards and upwards.
Absolutely. All of us would be hoping, you know, this is the start of something really brilliant for Mitch Marsh. We've seen him shine in multiple occasions for Australia as well. And although his fairy tale innings unfortunately came to an end, the rest of Australia's like lower middle order really did not show resilience as they folded, you know, for 263. So do you think that was like a good batting performance nonetheless in the first innings?
I think it was all about those two batters that you mentioned, you know, Mitchell Marsh and Travis Head. Even though Travis Head was a bystander for a good part of that partnership, we don't often say that, you know, you generally see Travis Head being the dominator, but that was how good Mitchell Marsh was. But on either side of it, it was England who dominated. And, you know, there's this this famous subcontinental adage which says, pace is pace, yaar. And I mentioned about Mark Wood and his exhilarating bowling. You know, that's what happens when you have that extra bit of pace, you know, someone who can just target the stumps relentlessly. The lower order will not be able to survive on most days. I mean, it's not that they're not good enough, but it's a different proposition altogether. You just don't want to be facing someone bowling that fast. And Mark Wood was unstoppable that day. So it wasn't a surprise that the moment Mitchell Marsh and Travis Head got out, it just came apart for Australia. But yeah, I mean, it depends on how you look at it. You want to look at the glass as half empty or half full, because when they were 80 for 4 at lunch, I think they would have taken 263 with both hands, especially after losing the toss. But I mean, on the stroke of tee, they would have thought, okay, we've got a great chance of getting to 350 at least. So it depends on which way you look at it, but it was not a bad batting performance. It could have been a lot better, but yeah, I mean, to be very fair to Australia as well, you know, they've been on the wrong side of conditions. You know, more often than not, they've been batting under overcast conditions. And you know, even at Lords, and every time it was sunny, it was only England batting, and every time it, you know, Australia were batting, it was overcast. But yeah, I mean, I think the second innings performance would probably hurt them more than the first innings.
Right, and we will get to that second innings performance as well. But I think one of the biggest talking points, obviously, and we earlier also spoke about this, was Mark Wood and, you know, Chris Wokes. They wreaked havoc on that Aussie batting with that brilliant bowling performance, giving nothing away to the Aussie batters as well. So how good was that to see, and how impressive is it to see that England has actually a very good pace batting now in the aftermath of Stuart Broad and Jimmy Anderson hanging up their boots? There's still so much to look forward to, right?
Oh, brilliant. I mean, you know, Chris Wokes was very unfortunate, I think, to miss out on selection at Lords too, because he has an outstanding record there. And in general, Chris Wokes has been a very different cricketer at home in tests as compared to away from home. So It was quite clear as to why they went for Georgetown, because they wanted that little bit of extra pace at Lord's. But Vokes made his mark, in both innings. And I think, as I said, those fresh legs, in Wood and Vokes just allowed England to, play a couple of quicker bowlers. I mean, Vokes isn't really the quickest going around, but, the way Robinson was struggling in the first two tests, he eventually bowled quicker than him. And of course, with Mark Wood, velocity is what comes to mind when you think of him. So, the added fact that they didn't have that baggage on their shoulders from the first two tests, I think that certainly helped England's cause. So, that was quite terrific from Vokes and Wood. And the way they just turned up, because sometimes when you come straight into a test without much match practice behind you, you can also show a lot of ring rust, but that wasn't the case. They were on the money from the word go. So you could see that they were quite charged up and they were determined to leave a mark. And I think that's what the Ashes brings out of you. It just brings the best out of players.
Exactly. And even when you look at the test match at last, it was more like the bowlers really dominating. So even when you look at England's first innings, quite similarly, like Australia, they had a tricky start. They lost their top order quite cheaply. So how would you assess that first innings for them?
Yeah, it's quite interesting because, I think England were looking to play positively from the word go. The scoring rate was around 5 per over. And I mean, that's how they've been approaching it over the last year, of course. But, I think we've got to give credit to the way Australia bowled. I think they bowled really well in that passage of play before stumps. And Pat Cummins especially was on top of his money. And I think Mitchell Starc has really grown as the series has gone along. He just seemed completely off in the first innings at Lord's. But, ever since they went to the short ball ploy against the English batters at Lord's, he's looked a different bowler, and he seems to have found his classical in-swinger as well. So and he's developed a new scramble seam delivery that angles across. So I think he's just gotten into his act, and when Mitchell Starc gets into his act, he's a completely lethal bowler altogether. I think it was pretty good from Australia that they made those inroads and managed to get Joe Root in early. And of course, the next morning, they managed to nip him out even earlier. Pat Cummins has had Root's number throughout the series. And, he's been quite relentless. So, you've got to be blessed to have a bowler like Pat Cummins in your ranks because he'll just run in all day. He'll bowl, in that channel on a consistent basis. And, of course, it's a plain simple rule when it comes to test cricket. You've got to take 20 wickets and you can see that aggression every time he's there at the top of his mark. He's charged up, and Australia would have known that the way that the pitch was behaving, or the life in the pitch for fast bowlers to take advantage of. They would have known that a few early wickets would have put them in. So it was a pretty good start, and until Ben Stokes took over, I think it was a really good start.
Exactly. And that kind of does bring me to Ben Stokes, because he, any adjective would be, would not be enough to describe his presence in this team, right? Again, he played an absolute captain's knock. He played with a lot of composure as well. So how do you reckon, that knock was crucial in the context for England and, really set things up, right?
Oh, it was massive because they were staring at a huge deficit, in the first innings. By the time they lost, I think Chris Wokes' wicket on the stroke of lunch on the second day, they were really staring down the barrel, and it was all down to Stokes. And one thing Stokes has really mastered over time, if you see, is the art of batting with the tail. It's truly an art, to know which batter or which lower order batter to trust with the strike, how many deliveries to trust or entrust him with, and also knowing, when to hang back and when to take the attack. He did it beautifully at Lord's. He did it 4 years ago at this very venue in that famous innings, along with Jack Leach. So, Ben Stokes, I think what really sets him apart is his ability to just come up clutch when his team is in a desperate situation. When you push them to the wall, he will really stand up. And, I think it's just a reflection of the kind of steely nerves that he's made with. That he's made of, and the character that just defines Ben Stokes. And I think over the last year I was quite disappointed with the way he was approaching his innings, because it just felt that he was tipping the line of being reckless in a bit to be aggressive. And Ben Stokes is a far better player than that. He's technically so equipped, he can always take his time. He doesn't need to, really go crash bang all up every single time. And over these last two tests, I think that's what he's done. He's decided to stay true to this game, and it's automatically reflected in results, for him and for the team. And I think very few players have the ability to flick a switch and just go from first gear to sixth gear within no time. And if you're an opposition captain or bowler, you're just wondering, okay, what's going on? And I think all said and done, Ben Stokes brings an X factor. It's Ben Stokes. That's the end of the story, and you know that until you get him out, the game is not done. And the way he reduced the deficit to 26, I think it was instrumental, because if you look at the eventual margin of result, they won by 3 wickets. So, you add a few runs over there, or rather, a few runs to Australia's lead, it could have been a completely different story. So, once again, Ben Stokes, the Ashes at home, it's quite a story in itself, isn't it?
Absolutely. And under Brendan McCullum, he just seems to, keep getting better, always, raising the stakes in the game, which is amazing to see. And for an Ashes contest, nothing like it. And talking about his contemporary captain now, you have Pat Cummins, right? He was instrumental in breaking the English batting. And he returned with impressive figures and a haul of 6 wickets, right? So how phenomenal was that? And does Pat Cummins really strengthen the case for a bowler captain?
He certainly does, because one thing you want to see with the bowler captain is he needs to be a sure shot starter in your playing 11, which Pat Cummins is every day of the week. The only catch that comes with it is his workload and how you manage that, because I am all for bowler captains, because I do feel that they just bring something different in terms of their thought process. But at the same time, it comes with its pros and cons in terms of workload management in particular. We saw Jasprit Bumrah captain in the fifth test, the rescheduled fifth test last year at Edgbaston. And, I'd love to see what he brings as captain, but will he play every single test for India, especially on the back of this injury? I'm not so sure. But, I've been a little critical of Cummins' captaincy and field placements, if I were to be very honest, throughout this series. But one thing he does bring is, as I said, natural aggression as a fast bowler. And at the top of his mark, he just knows what he's going to bowl. And he just knows that he has to get the batter in front of him out. And it's not for no reason that he's been the top-ranked bowler in the ICC rankings in Test for a while. I mean, I know that Ravichandran Ashwin is on top at this point of time. But, Cummins is right up there in the top echelon of fast bowlers in Test cricket today. I mean, those numbers itself tell you a story. A bowling average of 22 for someone who's taken well over 220 wickets is just outstanding. And, that was one of the best spells that I've seen this series. The way he's managed to square Joe Root up time in and time out. I mean, you're talking about one of the best batters in the world in a purple patch. And to be able to do that, it's just phenomenal. And, I'm pretty sure he's going to have a huge role to play if Australia are to win the series. And I'm quite happy that he got a fiver as well, because, I remember the last time out, he took a truckload of wickets, but he didn't get a fiver. He didn't get onto any honours board and all of that. He took like 28 wickets last time in 2019. And, he emerged as a leading wicket taker. So, he's one of those consistent performers who just toil in day in and day out. And, he's definitely an inspiring figure there in that Australian team. There's no doubt about it.
And even for us onlookers, right, seeing his evolution as that lanky 17-year-old pacer making his debut to now, leading Australia, leading the pack and, just snapping wickets so beautifully is again, a fairy tale in itself. And even when you look at Australia's second innings, they had a quite lukewarm one. But we saw some resistance from Usman Khawaja and Manaz Labuschagne as they held fort. But somewhere, David Warner and, Steve Smith couldn't quite, capitalize on the opportunities they had. So what were your thoughts on that performance?
I think that was the passage of play where Australia should have really stamped their authority on the test. And, driven the innings forward to a state of dominance, but unfortunately, I think that's where they lost the test, because some of the short selection as well, left a lot to be desired. I think both Labuschagne and Steve Smith really just gifted their wickets away, out of real harmless deliveries, and those shots were you expect better from Labuschagne and Smith. Labuschagne didn't go through with his alien sweep. He should have just either gone through it or kept it along the ground. It was neither. And Steve Smith just, chipping it to mid-wicket. You know, his reaction said it all. You know, he was, I'm sure when they look back at it, they know that they are better players and, you know, they shouldn't have played that shot. And if anything, it might just motivate them and bring the best out of them for the next game. But, and again, Warner and Stuart Broad, that whole saga has continued once again. So I think that's where Australia were in a dicey situation because the lead, you know, as valuable as it was, wasn't a huge one. So it meant that they were in a tricky situation. And once Usman Khawaja also got out and you had the crowd also, rallying behind England, you just knew that it wasn't going to be easy. And life became tougher when the clouds came in the next day and overcast conditions once again welcomed Australia. So I think it was that passage of play which was the turning point in the test.
Absolutely. Many people, even on social media, agreed with this. Like, that there was a whole momentum shift in that passage of play. Yet another positive was, again, Travis had spoken about him too. And he showed once again that he's made of steel because he performed really well. That knock of 77 really, tilted the tides in favor of Australia. So what do you think has been working so well for him? Because Australia for a long time, he wasn't a consistent player in that playing 11 as well, and although he had truckloads of runs in domestic cricket somewhere, he wasn't able to stamp his place. But with each series we see him emerge as such an important player, right, for Australia.
Absolutely, I think he's one of the most important cogs in that Australian wheel now. And if you cast your mind back to the Border Gavaskar Trophy series of 2018-19, Head, I think, was just playing his third test at the start of that series, if I'm not wrong. And, that was a depleted Australian side, without Warner and Smith. And you just felt that, even though he looked good while he was out there in the middle, he was probably stuck between knowing when to attack and when to defend. And I think that's been the story of Travis Head over the years. But since the 2021 Ashes, I think that was where his career pivoted. And he's just clear on his role and he's just going to go out there and express himself. And once again, he's done that in a manner that's not reckless. There are chinks in his game. We'll be very honest about it. The short ball does trouble him, especially when it's bowled at extra pace. He has his issues against spin too, but he doesn't shy away from expressing himself. He'll stick to his strengths. He will play his shots whenever the opportunity presents itself. And I think that clarity in terms of his role and how to go about, building a test innings. I mean, it's not the conventional, let's say Cheteshwar Pujara way of building a test innings, or even a Manas Labashin or an Usman Khawaja way of building a test innings, if we were to take examples from his own teammates. But he's going about doing it in his own way, and he's firing on a consistent basis. So and it always just adds that extra bit of spice to the game, because all of a sudden you're just posing questions of the opposition. So a counter attacker in test cricket has a lot of value, and I think Travis Head, that clarity in his role has helped. And I'm pretty sure that he's just in a very good headspace right now. No pun intended there, but it's just working out really well for him. And it's so good to see, because I always felt that he's someone with a lot of potential, and it's great to see that he's realizing it finally at the international level.
Exactly. And even when we look at England's bowling right now, you had Stuart Broad and Chris Wokes were super impressive. They were ably supported by the rest of the English bowling as well. So how would you rate that bowling performance? Because all through this episode, we've been raving about the bowlers doing so well. But amazing effort, you reckon?
Absolutely. I think it was a bowler's test in many ways, wasn't it? And if anything, they'd probably just look back and look back at the fact that they allowed Travis Head to hang around with the tail and give Australia a psychological lead of 250. But overall, I think, they were on the money. And, they just knew when to attack with the short ball ploy, especially against Head. And, we've got to give a lot of credit to the English attack for the way they performed in the second innings, because they were also a bowler down. They didn't have Ollie Robinson to turn to. Ben Stokes wasn't fit. He was struggling with his glute even while he was batting. So, the only other option they had was Joe Root. I think Moeen Ali bowled an excellent spell towards the end of day two, when he got both Labuschagne and Smith out, and didn't let Australia off the hook. And he just kept things very tight. And that also meant that Head had just far too much work to do eventually. And yeah, I mean, Broad has been terrific all series, and Wokes and Wood, I think we've spoken a lot about you know how they've just added that extra cutting edge to this bowling attack. So, and I think it was a terrific performance, except for that you know, for the last two wickets where they just allowed Australia to get past 200 and eventually 250. But again, you know, that's what Test cricket is all about. Eventually, you will have the counter punch coming your way. I mean, England have been doing it themselves. So overall, I think they'll be very pleased, especially after the first two tests. They'll be mighty pleased with how they do.
Right. And that's how, you know, even the task for them was cut out, right? Chase 251 and win the test match. Yet they had a tricky start. They lost Ben Duckett early on. So did you think at this point, you know, England lost momentum, you know, losing such a crucial battle? Did you still have hopes that, you know, a win was on cards?
Absolutely. You know, I did feel that as long as Joe Root and Ben Stokes were there, England were always in this chase. You know, the wicket was still fairly decent enough to bat on. And, you know, for what it's worth, I'm pretty sure that the rain would have had its effect in terms of, you know, just evening things out, even though there was a bit of uneven bounce on display on the second day. You know, we saw rain on the third day for a good part of the day. In fact, I didn't expect that we'd probably get to see any play, you know, on day three. I must mention that day three is also jinxed as far as the series is concerned. We've seen a lot of overs lost on day three at Edgbaston. You know, we saw the same happen at Lords and now at Headingley as well. But coming back to the chase, I think as long as Root and Stokes were there, England always had a chance. The only time I felt England were on the back foot was when they lost Ben Stokes and they had a lot of work to do. But, you know, as far as the start was concerned, Mitchell Starc, again, he was just on fire because, you know, he got the ball to tail in to the left-handers. You know, I think the delivery he bowled to, you know, send Moeen Ali stumps or, you know, walking, it was quite brilliant. And it was quite interesting that England decided to send Moeen Ali up to three as well. And personally, I really did endorse that move because I feel that the number three has to be technically sound, especially when, you know, technically well-equipped to handle movement, let me just say that, because Moeen Ali is a beautiful stroke maker, you know, very languid and easy on the eye. But I think you know, he's probably more comfortable against the older ball rather than, say, facing movement. You know, his game is centered around that. So I wasn't really a fan of that move. But yeah, I mean, again, I think England, it wasn't the easiest of chases because they were losing wickets at regular intervals. But, you know, the one thing you could see was, you know, they just kept putting Australia under pressure by taking the scoreboard along and, you know, just forced them into the defensive as well later on. So, yeah, it was a very interesting passage of play because, you know, the game was just, you know, right in the balance and you just couldn't pick a side at that point of time. But I did feel England were marginally ahead as long as Root was there or Ben Stokes was there. So I think that definitely, you know, that always gives you a psychological edge. They're just masters in their craft.
Exactly. And, you know, just dialing back to your point about how, you know, Moeen Ali was promoted at number three with such a crunch situation on your plate, you know, trying to experiment with this was probably not the best thing. Yet, you know, we had Zach Crawley who held his ground, although we had crucial wickets of Moeen Ali and Joe Root that fell. And, you know, do you think there was a panic that was setting in and, you know, the dependence on, again, Ben Stokes to come bail them out?
I think the... I'm not sure about the panic aspect because, you know, this team has just, you know, shown a lot of confidence, you know, irrespective of the result. But once Joe Root got out, I'm pretty sure, you know, there would have been a few uh-ohs in, you know, in that dressing room or amongst English fans because, you know, that is amongst the biggest wickets that can fall in the series. And, you know, Harry Brook hadn't quite, you know, converted his starts in the first two tests as well. So, you know, once again, it would have come down to Ben Stokes. But, you know, I think that's where, you know, England would have been thankful that the target was 251 and not 351 because that might have just, you know, once again, brought the onus back on Stokes to pull off what he did at Headingley or what he threatened to do at Lords. But, you know, overall, I think, you know, you're just seeing a lot of functional components in the batting lineup, which is good. You know, they might not have necessarily come together at once, but, you know, they made their presence felt at different points of time. So I'm sure that would have given them quite a bit of confidence. That, as well as the fact that they bat pretty deep. They bat quite, you know, very deep, in fact, in this test.
Right, and that's when the knock of Harry Brook also comes into focus, right? I think his knock really eased the tension to some extent. So how would you assess his progression? We've seen him in the IPL having a tough one, but he's a pretty good scorer in the county games, and even in the limited opportunities that he's had for England so far, we've seen his growth too, right? So how would you look at that?
He's a special player. There's absolutely no doubt about it. I mean, I always refer to this Harry as the chosen one. I think he's born to score a lot of runs. He comes from Yorkshire, and that's a county that's produced a lot of famous batters. Over time, right from the times of Geoffrey Boycott to Michael Vaughan, you've now got Joe Root, Johnny Bairstow. Harry Brook is right in that line, and I think it's going to come to nobody's surprise if he dominates world cricket for a lot of years to come. He's got his shortcomings, there's no doubt about it, against the moving ball and against spin too. We saw that in the IPL. But he's a confident lad. You can just see a lot of confidence in the way he plays for someone who's as young as him. And he likes scoring runs. He likes to bat and bat, and he does it at his own tempo. He's not going to hang around. He's not going to just go through the motions. And that's the way he approached this as well. He mentioned after the game too that he told Brendan McCullum that he wants to take on the Australian bowlers, and that reflects in his confidence over his game, and also the fact that he doesn't shy away from any situation. Come what may, he's up for the challenge, and that's what you want from a player playing at this level. If you want to succeed in Test cricket, you've got to have that attitude, and I think Brook has certainly got it. The way he just looks to score up almost every delivery. Ricky Ponting always talks about it that, don't look to survive, look for a scoring opportunity. If you feel that's out of the window, then just defend the ball and then move on. And I think Brook does that really well. He was comfortably dabbing the ball down to third man. He keeps nudging it around. And, whenever there's a loose delivery, he is going to put it to the fence. And I think this was a knock which you could say could potentially mark the coming of age of Harry Brook, because I know he's played, he scored bigger hundreds as well, in his short test career. But I think a knock like this with the Ashes on the line, a packed Headingley crowd with, with everyone backing you there. Obviously, there are a lot of Australian supporters as well. But the pressure there is intense, and he's playing his first Ashes series and against a quality bowling attack. It was quite remarkable that it went a long way in England sealing this match.
I agree, and this knock really did him a world of good and kind of even cements his place in that tough English batting lineup as well. Right, and now even when you look at how England lost a few wickets, there was this situation where the match is looking like they're slipping away from their control. And that's when you had the duo of Mark Wood and Chris Wokes who came through with their much needed knock stitch, that wonderful partnership. So how heroic was that effort and really lifted the English spirit, right?
Oh, truly. I mean, it was extremely heroic because they had just lost a set batter as well. Brook had just lost his wicket, and that could have also resulted in a bit of deja vu, because if you saw what happened at Lord's, the moment Ben Stokes got out, it all just came apart for England. It wasn't to be this time around, of course, because Wood and Vokes are significant upgrades as far as their batting is concerned when compared to their colleagues in the lower order. And Wokes for long was touted as, there was this discourse amongst fans of England as well a few years ago. Wokes was a better all-rounder than Ben Stokes because of his secondary skill, which is his batting being better than Stokes bowling. And I think he just showed just why he's rated so highly. And it was an amazing display of maturity, because he chose his moments once again. And one thing you get with Chris Wokes is, he's quite a hard batter to dismiss. And I think those are the ones who are really frustrating if you're a bowler in Test cricket. If you just don't know how to get that batter out, it can just start to tell on your lines and your radars. And I think the way he went about it, he took a semi-calculated route, and Mark Wood, of course, is Mark Wood. I mean, he's just going to come out there and do his bit, 24 of 8 in the first innings. I think probably telling Brendan McCullum, if you really want to endorse fastball, you need to send me up the order. And you know, you might have, you know, knowing the character that Mark Wood is, he might have actually gone ahead and told Brendan McCullum that too. He's a lovely character, and yeah, I mean, big nerves of steel again, you know, to be able to withstand that pressure and do it. And you know, again, they were the heroes in so many ways in this test. You know, with the ball and with the bat, you really wonder, you know, you take these two out of the game. You know, and I say this because they made their bow in the series for the first time, you know, in this test, having missed the first two tests. You really wonder, you know, if the Ashes would have slipped away from England already. So kudos to them, terrific this week.
Absolutely. I mean, these two really made the difference, you know, with their performance through the test as well. But even when you look at Australia's bowling, now Mitch Stark has been making the right noises, right, with his timely wickets, his abstinence from IPL, also, you know, contributing to his longevity in the longest format. So how would you look at his progression and consistency through the years?
Oh, truly, I mean, you know, Mitchell Stark, you know, I've always believed that the kind of skill set that he possesses, you know, the base swing, reverse swing, or, you know, the ability to bowl a mean Yorker, you know, if he gets it right, there are very few bowlers who are as lethal and nasty to face as Mitchell Stark. And, you know, I was quite disappointed with the way he bowled in the first innings at Lord's, as I mentioned earlier. It just felt that he was bowling all over the place. He had an ordinary time in the WTC final too. But, you know, I'm sure that he would have had that determination to come out there and make a statement. You know, we've seen Mitchell Stark do this over the years. You know, every time there have been question marks, he has answered in his own inimitable style. And, you know, that is just blowing the stumps away, bowling with aggression and, you know, just showing the world that he means business. And it's, you know, he is a box office bowler in many ways. You know, you pay to watch a Mitchell Stark bowl when he's in full rhythm. And, you know, I think the way he performed in this test across the two innings, you know, it was outstanding. And he always brings, a point of difference with his left arm angle and, you know, that extra bit of pace as well, you know, which you want on flat surfaces. So when Mitchell Stark performs like that, Australia are a completely different team altogether. And, you know, it's great to see that, you know, he seems to have found his mojo here, because you just tend to associate Mitchell Stark with alternating periods of the highs and the lows when it comes to his form in Test cricket in particular. You know, he's had two home BGTs where he has underperformed. But, you know, in between that, he's been brilliant. And once again, you know, he's just brought his A game to the fore, you know, just when Australia needed it. Unfortunately, in a losing cause this time around. But if he bowls like this, you know, England's batters will have a challenge in tackling him at Manchester and in London as well for the last test.
Right. And although this test was a well-contested one, we got to see some quality cricket, and Australia did have some positives to take away as well. What do you think are some of the shortcomings that they would definitely, you know, want to take in their stride and, you know, eventually work on it as well?
I think there are a couple of issues to address in both departments. You know, with the bat, I think they definitely want more runs from David Warner and Manas Labuschagne. You know, they won't worry about Usman Khawaja's form. They certainly won't worry about Steve Smith or Travis Head too. And obviously, they've you know, good luck to whoever's selecting the team for the next test, because if Cameron Green is fit, that's a proper head scratcher now. You know, where does that leave Mitchell Marsh? Form does count for a lot, and you know, in the Ashes especially. You know, he's played a knock like this. You definitely don't want to leave him out after a knock like this. So, you know, I think they definitely want runs from Manas Labuschagne, because it has been a lackluster year for him. You know, 8 innings now in England. He's not got a half century. You know, he just got one half century in India as well. And that was on one of the flatter pitches. Of course, he's had his purple patch. You know, this happens to every player. But, you know, Australia, purely from the point of view of the next two tests, will hope that he has saved his best for the right moment. And, you know, with the ball too, you just, obviously Todd Murphy has big shoes to fill, you know, with no Nathan Lyon. And I hope they show more faith in him, because I think he's a really good bowler. You know, we saw what he did in India, and they just need to get him into the game a little earlier. I don't think Pat Cummins had the same kind of confidence in Murphy as he did with Nathan Lyon. Understandable, you know, because of the difference in experience. But I think there's a lot of merit in getting him earlier into the game and, you know, just using any early moisture in the pitch. You know, let's say you're bowling first and there's a bit of moisture initially, you want to get your spinner on, because spinners can benefit from it too. Or just in general, just throw him in and give him that confidence and, just back him and say, go out there, just bowl your heart out. We've got this. And I think the bigger issue though for Australia would probably be the third seed. I expected Scott Boland to pick up a heap of wickets. Unfortunately, it hasn't happened. Josh Hazlewood also hasn't quite looked at his best rhythm. They released Michael Neeser to play a county game for Glamorgan and he's smashed a mammoth 100 and he's taken wickets. So does he come into the picture? I'll just put it out there. I'm a big Michael Neeser fan. I certainly won't mind seeing him in the next test. I think that's one area they'd probably want to address. Do they stick with Boland? Do they go back to Hazlewood? Or do they just throw the cat among the pigeons with Neeser? And, just like how, England responded with fresh faces, whether Australia would also take that too. So these are a couple of things that they'd want to sort out. They've had a nice break. Between games, so they would have had enough time to dwell on it and eventually come to a decision. So it remains to be seen as to what path they eventually tread.
Right, and if you were to don the hat of the Aussie selector, what would your team combination and composition look like?
This is tough. This is genuinely tough, to be honest, Neha, because I think I would, take the call with Michael Neeser. I'd bring him in. I mentioned at the start of the series as well that in a very tightly crammed series, squad rotation amongst your fast bowlers especially is going to be critical. And one thing with Neeser is he offers a lot of value with the new ball. He swings it both ways. His batting is a bonus. I mean, yes, he is a bowling all-rounder, but at the end of the day, he's good enough to be part of a frontline pace attack. And I won't mind taking that gamble unless Hazlewood is like really fit and he's bowling with his usual rhythm in the nets, which hasn't quite reflected so far on the tour. But if they're confident about Hazlewood and if let's say I'm watching Hazlewood in the nets and I feel that, okay, he just seems to be on top of his game, he's had a nice break, a long break, he might just come in fresh and pose a lot of problems, then I'd probably go back to Hazlewood because I don't think I don't think Scott Boland has worked out in this series so far, at least. He has lacked wickets, and you can see why. He's just not bowling full enough, which maybe Hazlewood might be able to do. Or Michael Neeser's natural length, in fact, is to bowl a little fuller. So I definitely, I wouldn't mind taking that chance with Neeser. Back-to-back tests again, so let's not forget that, you've got to keep that in mind and, pick your best combination so that, you have a fit bowling attack for the last game too. The big call is going to be on who makes way if Cameron Green is fit again. Do you decide to keep Green on the bench? He brings a lot of value across departments. A gun fielder at gully too, for what it's worth. Apart from banging the ball into the track and extracting that extra bit of bounce, there is a bit of discourse around whether David Warner's the one who could make way. Will they move the others up by a spot, or potentially will they just ask Travis Head to open the batting again? Do you want to do that after the success he's had this tour at number 5? I'm a little touch and go. If it was a test in the subcontinent, I would have said go ahead. Because not just because he did it in India, but I think for his limitations against spin, batting against a new ball and taking the attack, is probably where he thrived really well. But it's a different ball game in England. So, I think that it's a bit of a tough call. I'm certainly quite glad that this is a hypothetical hat that I'm wearing, and I'm not in the selector's shoes. I'm not in Pat Cummins or George Bailey's shoes, in order to make this decision. So, but yeah, I mean, it is a hard one. Mitchell Marsh has definitely given them a hard job now.
Exactly. This one's going to be quite tricky, and I'm actually interested to see how the next test and the selection pans out as well. And even when you look at this test match at last, now England end up on the winning side, owing to their good performances in clutch moments. But what do you think are some of the areas that England can definitely work on? Because the next test has some days to start. And what do you think, they would want to go back to the drawing room and just have a look at?
I think for starters, they definitely want runs from Johnny Bairstow. They've backed him. They've not named another wicketkeeper in the side. He was given the gloves and asked to bat at number 7, at the start of the summer. They left Ben Folkes out of the equation. And of course, his wicket keeping has come under a lot of scrutiny, but the runs haven't come either. He's made headlines, but unfortunately, whether you can say it's for the wrong reasons or not, he's not made headlines for what he should be, which is for taking those catches on a consistent basis and scoring those runs. But they've thrown their weight behind him. And, they definitely want to score from him. I think Zach Crawley's got starts. He'd want to convert one of them too. But most importantly, I want to see what they do with their batting lineup, because they decided to bat Harry Brook at three. And after one innings, they backtracked on that and decided to go back to their original batting order, which was Brook at five, Stokes at six, and Johnny Bairstow at seven. As I mentioned earlier as well on the show, I'm not a fan of Moeen Ali at three. If I were Brendan McCullum or Ben Stokes, I'd have a word with Joe Root and ask him, are you comfortable going back to number three? Because I think if you look at batters who are technically equipped to bat at that position, I only see two in this England team. One is Root and the other is Stokes. Now, Stokes may not have much bowling to do again. He's been struggling with a dodgy knee. He struggled with his glute in the last game. They just want Stokes to be fit to play as a batter and captain. And after a long time on the park, I don't think Stokes would want to bat up immediately at number three. So I guess the only option you have is Joe Root. Move everyone up by a spot maybe. Brook at four. And then that means Stokes at five and Bairstow at six. But I think if there ever was a time for Joe Root to bat at three, probably be now. So, I think that's one thing that they'll have to reflect on as to what their best batting order is, because, I don't think they got it right with Harry Brook going up to number three himself, because again, he's one of those free-flowing stroke makers. You push Bairstow down to seven to accommodate Brook at five. So you really don't want to deviate from that. What was wrong was they just gave him one innings, and I just hope they made up their mind. Whatever it is, they just need to be sure and show that conviction. And I think the best plan at this point of time would be to just approach Joe Root, because I don't think you'd see an extra batter come in. Stokes is not fit to bowl. I think England will still go in with the two all-rounders in Moeen plus Wokes and play three fast bowlers apart.
Right, that is actually quite interesting. And as we reach the end of our discussion too, what is your prediction on how the rest of the series will pan out? Do you expect, the Aussies to again give a tough fight and eventually come back to win the series? Or do you see England, fighting harder now that the momentum's on their side and actually make the series all the more exciting?
England is definitely going to fight hard, and, when Ben Stokes was asked after the last game, do you think you can win the Ashes 3-2? He just had a very crisp answer and he said, yeah. So they're confident, and I'm sure the last game would have given them a lot of confidence. But, it's hard to see this Australian team, not bounce back. I mean, that's the kind of team that they've got. They've got a lot of quality again. Had they just done a few things right in the last game, it could have easily been 3-0 in their favour. So I expect Australia to bounce back. Whether it'll be at Manchester, whether it'll be at the Oval, it remains to be seen. They'd certainly hope it's at Manchester. They don't want to, take it 2-2 into the Oval. I mean, it's going to. I wouldn't mind it as a neutral. Let me be very honest about it. I think it'll just set us up for one of the greatest cricketing spectacles that we've seen in a long time. And there's nothing quite like it. And I think it would be. It would be quite remarkable, but I'm not the best when it comes to predictions in the first place. But the way these two teams have played and the way it has just ebbed and flowed either way, it's already a very difficult series to predict. So I'm still going to say Australia will bounce back, but it's not going to be a walk in the park for sure. If there's anything that these three tests have taught us, it is that.
Either case, we're in for a cracker of, the remainder of the series. And there's so much to look forward to as well. And as we wrap up, do you have any final thoughts or a message for our listeners?
Well, I must thank you first up, Neha, for inviting me on the show. I had such a lovely time. I'm always on the lookout for, a passionate follower of cricket and and someone I can converse with. And as I said, this was my podcast debut. I don't think, I could have done it on a better show. So thank you so much. And it was quite lovely being a part of this discussion. And, when it comes to the Ashes, there's just so much to talk about, as always. And, we could probably keep going on and on. There's just There's just so much out there to discuss. So it was quite lovely. And, you know, of course, 208 episodes and counting. You're doing a fantastic job. And, you know, I'm sure your listeners are absolutely loving it too. So keep it going. And hopefully you'll have me back on the show once again. You know, I'd love to be back. And to all the viewers, of course, keep listening to Never on the Back Foot. And, you know, Neha will keep entertaining you with amazing insights and discussions around our favorite sport. I mean, you know, what better than talking cricket? I mean, that's, you know, I can't think of anything better than that now, can you?
Similar thoughts, Surya. I really loved having you on the episode today. Beautiful insights, the way you presented them, you know, with so much nuance and layers, really added so much flavor to our conversation as well. And on that note, I'd like to draw curtains on the episode. So here's hoping, you know, I can have you back on the podcast and we can keep talking about cricket endlessly. But until next time, stay safe and take care. Cheers.
Thank you, Neha. Take care. Bye-bye.
Last but not the least, thank you so much, listeners, for tuning into this episode and for your unstinted support. Please follow and press the bell icon on Spotify and subscribe to the podcast on Google Podcasts for the latest episode updates and stay tuned. Do check out @NeverOnTheBackFoot on Instagram and @NeverOnTheBackBar on Twitter for the latest facts, terminology, retweets, fresh tweets and a lot more that's coming up this cricket season just for you. The podcast is also available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Spotify for Podcasters, Overcast, and many other platforms. So please do spread the word. Until next time, stay safe and take care, listeners. Bye for now.